Welcome to the Thomas Coffee Metal Podcast, episode 67.
Greetings, everyone. Welcome to the Comics Coffee Metal Podcast. I'm your host, Don Cardenas, and we made it. We're in December. The end of the year is nigh. And yeah, like I was talking a little bit last episode, there's a lot of stuff trying to get done this year, and I just kind of added a couple more things to that list. So yeah, we're going to go out with a bang or a whimper. Either way, we're going to go down fighting. So yeah, lots of cool stuff coming up. And speaking of cool stuff, let's waste no time and let's get right to those recommendations. All right, for my comic book recommendation this week, we have the awesome Winter Solstice Saturnalia themed anthology Yule, Dreadful Tales for the Holiday Season. Yule is edited and curated by Grant Stoy, with the logo and font design by Letter Squids, arranged by Tobin Rasiat, with some awesome cover art by Donna A. Black. Yule was a Kickstarter anthology that happened earlier in this year, and I was super glad that I jumped in on it. I think I got in at the very last second. And yeah, it's really, really, really fun. There is well over a dozen awesome stories here. And as with anthologies, you could have a varying degree of, I guess, I don't want to say quality, because that's an objective term. Just, you know, not everything's going to hit with everybody. You're not going to have a full-on 100% success rate with every story in an anthology as a reader. But with Yule, I can say that I think I did. Each one, you know, some of them are very, very short, but they are incredibly effective, which, you know, shouldn't surprise me at all, because I know Grant, and he's a fantastic editor and a really great guy, and yeah, he's a smart guy. He knows how to put stuff together. There's a just murderer's row of new talent on this book, from Melissa White, Heather Vaughn, Frankie White, Fellhound, Justin Jordan, Val Horvison, Jared Luan, Joe Corallo, the aforementioned Letter Squids, DC Hopkins, Meredith McLaren. Like, there's just, I can keep going on. There's so many awesome people involved with this book that it's a no-brainer. Now, you'll notice I haven't mentioned any of the stories specifically, and that's just because, you know, some of them are so brief, just kind of just mentioning the concept is kind of a spoiler. So, you know, I think it's best someone goes into this kind of sight unseen for a majority of the stories. But yeah, it's definitely worth, you know, taking that risk, especially since this is a ridiculously good deal. $5 for a PDF, or $12 for the print edition, both available at nounandverb.gumroad.com. Yeah, it's a no-brainer, man. Treat yourself this holiday season to some good horror comics, and especially some good seasonal horror comics. All right, my music recommendation this week is the debut album from the new band Scion. Scion consists of Howard Jones, of former Killswitch Engage and current Light the Torch fame, and the incredibly popular YouTube guitar musician Jared Dines. Now, I've mentioned quite a few YouTube guitar players' albums on this show, which I, you know, completely, I guess, cop to or whatever, because I listen to their channels and stuff like that and watch their channels and stuff. But, you know, it's also because these are some really good musicians. You know, they're putting in the time, the effort to just make really, really good music. And Jared is one of those creators who I think a lot of people are kind of divided on, because a lot of his stuff seems to be more, you know, kind of on the comedic side. And I think a lot of people kind of miss the point that he's really talented. He's a talented drummer, vocalist, and guitar player. I mean, he has his own signature guitar from Ernie Ball. I mean, it's kind of nuts, being that he hasn't had a popular band in yet until this debut album, which is doing fantastic on the charts. It is just killing it. And that is in no small part to his collaborator, Howard Jones. Howard Jones has probably the biggest metal voice, I think, of this generation. His, you know, while people can have similar, I guess, similarly effective or powerful growls as he does, his clean singing voice just it's one of those things that just kind of just like encompasses whatever melody he's doing and whatever emotion he's trying to bring. He just kind of just, it's incredibly powerful. If you listen to his stuff with Killswitch Engage or Light the Torch, you know exactly what I'm talking about. So when I saw it was announced that these two gentlemen were joining forces after they had met, I believe, on a Trivium tour where Jared was helping out playing some guitar duties there, I was definitely interested. I liked some of Jared's original solo efforts he was putting out, and Howard Jones, amazing vocalist. I'm not 100% a Killswitch or Light the Torch fan, but I always liked what I hear when I do. They are definitely two projects that I have to kind of take the time and go and dig into, because I'm sure I'm going to enjoy what I hear when I do. I also should note that the Killswitch Engage cover of Holy Diver with Howard Jones is probably one of my favorite cover songs of all time. It is a constant on any heavy playlist I have, so there is that. And the longer I take getting into Howard Jones's projects, the more it just makes me feel silly, because I seem to like everything he does. Now, onto this album. I was kind of curious what this album was going to sound like. They had released a couple singles throughout the year, The Blade, and I believe More Than Just Myself. And they were good, really good. They had the kind of metalcore influence, but I was kind of interested what the whole album would be like as a whole. And I was very, I don't want to say pleasantly surprised, because again, I like these gentlemen, I like their music. So I was just hoping it'd be something cohesive, like an Audioslave record, and not something that's just kind of two guys doing what they prefer musically separately, and then it's just mixed together, you know, willy-nilly. But no, it's a very incredibly solid album. There's more that I like the more that I dig into it. It's only been out for about a week or so, so I think it needs a little more time for me to sit in. But again, right off the bat, I really liked it. Like I said, you can definitely point to the influences of Killswitch Engage and stuff like Light the Torch, because Jared admittedly grew up listening to that stuff, and you know, that's in his musical DNA. But Jared also brings in a lot of different elements, and it really is something that's separate from those other two projects, which is kind of difficult when you have like the same vocalist. Like whenever a new vocalist starts a band, it's kind of hard not to make it feel like it's, you know, just another version of the band they were in before, since the vocals are such a hallmark or such a signature part of a band's sound. But I think Howard Jones with Killswitch and Light the Torch and now Cyan, it's really set apart, I think, and it has a lot to do with the musicians around them. I'm pretty sure that this entire album was recorded instrumentally all by Jared and Howard. I couldn't find any other credits for any drummers or bass players or anything like that. So, you know, even more kudos to them for making something that sounds like it's a whole new band. And, you know, while it definitely pulls from their previous projects and their influences and all that, it's its own thing. Now, picking a favorite song so far was pretty easy, just because the nature of the song. And right now, I must say, though, The Blade, More Than Just Myself, Drown, Great Deceiver, all fantastic tracks. The rest are all, you know, good too and growing on me increasingly. But my favorite so far off this album is Buried Alive and Wide Awake. And I think, it's just got the great vocal melody, great growling vocals. It's got that, you know, kind of halftime stomp groove that I am just such a mark for. It's not even funny. But yeah, it is definitely a great tune. And I'm, you know, excited to talk to you about this album, because I think a lot of you are really going to dig it. So let's listen to a bit of Buried Alive and Wide Awake. Cyan is available everywhere. It's like number one in the iTunes charts and all that. So congrats to those gentlemen. This is completely self-produced. And while they're both successful in YouTube and musical efforts, you know, on their own, it's still an uphill battle when you're doing a new project and doing something kind of untested in this way. So congrats to them. Looking forward to see what the future brings. Here is Buried Alive and Wide Awake. On to my guest for this week. And to keep this short and sweet, Christopher Cibola is a fantastic writer. I've had the pleasure of knowing him for a good handful of years, and his talent and just pure razor-sharp thinking and ability to come up with incredibly awesome concepts and deliver on those concepts has just grown exponentially with every passing project. I'm totally stoked that we got the chance to sit down and talk. He's a really fun, smart, and thoughtful guy, and I'm already looking forward to the next time we get a chance to sit down and chat. All right, Christopher Cibola, let's go. In the now 67th episode of this show, I am still coming across people who I really, really want to have another chat with, and I am so glad that I have my guest here today. He is an amazing writer. I've followed his work for, I checked, it's like almost a decade now, which seems just really crazy. I think last time we actually spoke in person was a few years ago at C2E2, and I am just, you know, incredibly glad you're here. All your work since then has just been amazing. Your creator-owned output has been just phenomenal, and it's kind of scary how good you're getting as a writer and how crazy your concepts are and just how much I dig them. And I just, you know, whichever new project you have, I'm like, this is awesome. How can you top this? And you still manage to figure out some crazy ass way to like come up with something even more interesting, more prescient, more just more gooder. See, that's why you're the writer. So I want to talk to you about all your cool projects you've had and a whole bunch of other stuff. But first, Christopher Cibola, Comics Coffee Metal, what are you digging right now?
Right now, I'm reading Josh Cotter's Not Away, which is now, his second volume just came out. It's this big, long sci-fi epic, and he's like a secret genius of comics that everyone should be talking about, but they're not. Coffee wise, I'm back to going to my local coffee shop. Pretty much I try to go daily, to support them and myself. Yeah, I always get a 4-shot Americano, on ice, because I can't drink it hot anymore.
No.
My brain, just, getting it iced means I can like drag it out for an hour or two if I need to. Metal. I was looking at that Metallica Clue game. That's about as close as I get to metal right now.
I know. You know, you're not a huge Metallica fan, but I know you are. Not avid rewatcher, but you've watched that Some Kind of Monster documentary a few times.
I love it. Yeah, it is so close. I'm making a joke about the Clue game, like on Twitter, about their therapist, Phil Towle.
I've already made a few jokes about that Clue game on Twitter. It's just, you know, I love Metallica. They are my number one band of all time. But I also, you know, yeah, they're kind of ridiculous.
It feels very, very Gene Simmons of them to start putting out Clue games and stuff. But so, I'm here for it. If it leads to another documentary like that, they can do whatever they like.
There you go. I kind of wish that Clue game was something that was like you can play online, because there's a few buddies when I was tagged into it, who tagged me into, like, let me know about it. I'm like, I would just love to play this game with you guys. Like, you know, I'm sure there's going to be just endless games of people hoping Lars is the victim.
Sure.
Somehow. And
they should get, like, but they should, like, get, they should have gotten, like, Newstead to sign on and Mustaine. Yeah. Like, they could be, like, because all suspicion would go on them every round.
Exactly. Exactly. It was Mustaine in the tuning room with his Kerry King flying V. Oh, boy. going back, that coffee order you have, that's a pretty hefty order. Is that like the one you have a day, and then you're like, okay, yeah, I'm done? Okay.
I mean, as far as coffee goes, like, I'm still... caffeine doesn't really, you know, like, it just doesn't affect me very much. But also, I don't want to get, like, huge splitting headaches. So, but I work late into the night, and I don't know, caffeine at night just, like, makes sense to me. But I can, I mean, like, I can have, I've fallen asleep while drinking, you know, an iced Americano with four shots in it. So, yeah, that's far from my last taste of caffeine in a day. I've been working on making coffee more at home. But I am, like, weirdly addicted to that Starbucks, just, like, iced coffee. It's not even, like, the cold brew stuff. It's just iced coffee. But, like, I don't know what they do to it, but when I drink it, it tastes like there's an aftertaste of, like, cereal milk to it that I just, it's amazing. And I don't know how they do it. I can't figure it out, but there's something, like, it tastes like drinking the remnants of, like, you just had a bowl of cornflakes. So there's some sort of weird corn. And I get the unsweetened version, so it's not like corn syrup. But also, corn syrup doesn't taste like corn. I don't know. It's a thing that haunts me. But I try to at least... going to the coffee shop at least just gives me an excuse to,
get out of the house.
Actually do some work. Yeah. Like, it's a good reset for my brain, because, you know, I live here and I work here, and eventually it gets hard to, you know, if you're trying to work in the same place that, like, you know, you the other night you pounded like three movies in a row while stoned, like, it, the lines begin to blur a bit.
Yeah. My wife often and I were often like, we wish just like a half decent coffee shop within walking distance from our house, and there's not. But it's one of those things where it's just be nice just to get out, even if it's just like a Dunkin' Donuts that was close by or something.
Right.
Everything in our little suburb is like at least a mile away. At the very least, and it's like, well, that's not a quick walk if you're trying to do something. But yeah, it's
And what suburb are you in?
I'm in Waukegan.
Okay.
So about 45 minutes, not yeah. 45 minutes, about 40 miles north of Chicago.
I grew up in Chicago, so like I definitely know Waukegan as a place, but I don't think it's a place I ever hung out in.
Yeah, I mean, I was born and raised in Chicago, and, you know, we were, young, way too young to be buying a house, and we bought a house up here because we were kind of lured in from, like, the development plans they had for the town, and this was, like, the early 2000s, like, really early 2000s, and then the mid-2000s happened,
sure.
And any plans this town had to, like, be built up into some sort of, like, you know, harbor, reclaim their status as like a popular harbor town just went out the window, and they've been trying to like climb up that pole again. And it's right. just not working. And, you know, we're here, you know, on the, at this point on the shorter side of a mortgage.
Well, there you go.
So it's fine. But no, it's the more time I spend away from Chicago, because at the time, also, my wife and I, we worked in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
So we would be driving an hour and a half in and back every day.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, now that she's working up here after we had kids and I, you know, did, you know, found some stuff I can do at home on top of freelance art and being dad. You know, we're not in Chicago very often, and the more time I'm away from it, the more, you know, I like, the less patience I have for it.
Oh, yeah.
When I do go in. Even just visiting my parents, I'm like, how do we, like, everyone's too close together. I don't like this.
See, I had the opposite. Like, the last time I was back, like, for a good sustained visit, I was like, well, this town is so huge and sprawling. Like, why is it so big? I don't know. Like, Portland's a pretty big city, but it's very hemmed in. But Chicago just, like, kind of keeps spreading out. It just really, for some reason, got to me. I was like, why is this city so big? Like, this seems unnecessary.
Well,
but
yeah, and it's also like the whole Chicago land thing. It's like people say like, oh, we're in Chicago. It's in Chicago, and it's like, no, it's Skokie. Like,
right, yeah.
Basically, anything within 50 miles of Chicago, people like to say it's Chicago. It's like, no, it's not.
Yeah,
Chicago's big enough, and like, you don't need to like extend those borders, but I do get what you're saying, because if you're like downtown and stuff like that, it's like the immensity of the city is kind of like intimidating, even for someone like me who's, you know, who lived most of his life there.
But yeah, I mean, I grew up there, like it, I thought like that all seemed normal to me, and then I guess I saw the rest of the world and I was like, no, this is too big and spread out. Like, you guys need to contract a bit.
There's too many people. So now I'd mentioned that, you know, I've been a fan of your work for probably almost a decade now. I was trying to think, like, when's the first time I heard of your work? And it had to be Screamland.
That's crazy early. Like,
I think when I checked, it was like 2011.
Yeah, that's my very first published thing.
And I'm pretty sure I heard about it on a podcast. And I don't know if I've ever actually, I don't recall ever actually reading it, but I just remember knowing about it and thinking like, that's a really fucked up cool idea. Like, I should check this out. But I think at the time I was still like not fully getting into indie comics. I was still like, I was back in the reading comics.
Right.
But I was still suckling at the teat of like Marvel and like,
sure,
DC. So I didn't really give it a lot of independent comics a look. Now it's, you know, complete opposite. But then I'm like, okay, what's the next thing? And of course, that was High Crimes.
Yeah.
And that was the next one where I was like, well, I definitely have to check this out. Just because the concept of, you know, someone who makes their living, you know, finding the bodies of people who died on a on Everest is, you know, that's it's not something I've knew was a thing. So I'm like, and you made a really, really, really interesting thriller with that, of course, with Ibrahim and all that doing some fantastic artwork. So it kind of became this, it started the whole trend for me, for when it's like, I saw you were getting like, you know, some big two work here and there, doing some licensed stuff, but it seemed like whenever you had a creator-owned project come out, it felt like this was like pure undistilled your voice. And since then, I think you've been on a fairly steady roll with your creator-owned work. Do you feel that doing stuff for a larger publisher is kind of not necessarily behind you, because I'm sure you would just destroy in the best way, like some big two properties and stuff like that. But do you feel like that kind of, that work is not what kind of like feeds you anymore?
Yeah.
Figuratively speaking.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean, doing big two stuff was, you know, I think everybody who gets into comics wants to do that stuff. And I definitely did. But there was a thing where I got DC put me on this Injustice Ground Zero book, which was, basically telling the story of the video game, as a comic book. And it was like a digital weekly thing. And it was like 12 print issues, 24 digital issues. And it just sort of ate up all my time and energy doing that thing. And when I was getting towards the end of it and like wrapping up my writing stuff, I remember kind of looking up and thinking like, oh crap, I don't have anything, like I don't have any creator owned stuff set up, like, and it just made me panic a bit, because it, like, the creator owned stuff's what I, you know, that's why I got into this, and that's what I'm here to do mostly, and doing like licensed or work for hire stuff is fun and it feeds sort of a different itch. But that was kind of the moment where I was like, I need to, you know, for me at least, I felt like I needed to pick a team. And you know, we all of us have a limited amount of time and energy on this earth to get done what we want to do. And I think, yeah, I just, I don't know, sometime in around, it was like right before Crowded started coming out, I think I just kind of decided that I wasn't going to chase Big Two stuff anymore. I wasn't going to like, dedicate my, mm-hmm. as much of myself to that side of the business as I had been, because I have all these ideas and I don't know where I'm going to put them, but I want to do them. So yeah, it's just ultimately more satisfying for me. I'm not operating under decades of canon that I have to, you know, sort of wind my story around or edit to fit. I get to invent my own worlds and make the rules. It's just sort of completely free. And I've never been good at like having jobs or bosses. And so I think ultimately it's what speaks to me is like, just let me go off and make a thing. And I promise you it'll be good. It might not be great, but it'll be good.
So when you, one of the things you just mentioned was, you know, you have all these ideas and, you know, what are you going to do with them? One of the things I do like seeing when you post on social media is you have quite a few composition notebooks.
Yeah.
And I always respect the way that you're just kind of relentless with them and just constantly writing, constantly keeping notes and having all these things. If you had to, like, I don't know if you have an exact number, but if you do, great. But if not, are you able to like guesstimate how many of these notebooks you have lying around?
Yeah, they're right on the shelf behind me. I mean, there's about, I don't know, under 20 that are complete. And then there are about 25 that are in progress to some degree or another.
I'll
say that.
Okay. Are they very much like project specific, or is it just kind of, some are project specific, some are just kind of just general, you know, note, like just, you know, whatever random idea, right, I have goes into this thing?
No, I have like one or two. Like I have, I make like work for hire notebooks. So, okay. I think I just wrapped up, maybe there's still some pages in it, volume two of that. And then I have a one that I call a woodshed, which is basically where I give myself a page to explore an idea and see if there's a story in there, like some weird idea that I think is cool, like trepanation or, teleportation or, I don't know, stuff that I just think about and think, mm-hmm. like, maybe there's something there. But all the other ones are book specific, and I only put notes about that book in that notebook. It's a good way to, it's like keeping diaries of every project. So yeah, they all have their own, they're all self-contained, and they're good like physical reminders of like, oh, okay, now that you're done with this notebook, you should check these three others that are sitting on the table and see what you need to do in them. But like, yeah, just physical note taking is, I don't know. It's just much more casual, and it sort of lets my brain work, in a way where it doesn't feel like it's being asked to work. Like, you know, I'm just making notes. Like, I'm just, jotting down ideas. So to my brain's way of thinking, this isn't work. This is just, you know, just me dreaming stuff up for fun. So yeah, that's kind of how I tend to treat it. And then lately I've been writing full issues in longhand, because of the fact that I've tricked my brain into thinking that notebooks aren't real work. I can at least like write the breakdowns for a whole issue.
That's cool.
Like while watching a movie, it's gotta be a movie that I'm pretty familiar with or don't care about. But it's a nice way to sort of, yeah, distract myself. Cause I'm my biggest obstacle in terms of getting stuff done in a quick and efficient manner.
I'm with you 100% there. I completely understand that. I think what fascinates me about that is so many writers, you hear about them taking their notes and all that, but you're almost like an artist with their sketchbook when you're like just talking about or showing, or you are an artist yourself. You do some amazing graphic design in your books, and you also, you know, mess with the covers of those books and stuff like that. So it's kind of like bridging that gap for me in my brain, like kind of like between a writer's sketchbook.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever used any of that stuff for like back matter for like a collected edition of a book, or is it just like, no, this is too raw, or just, you know?
No, I mean, I would if I thought there was interest there, but it seems mostly just interesting to myself. I can't think of any, like, I used to, before I like got really deep into working in comics, like I used to have just a general purpose notebook that, you know, I just jot down notes in. So, like I can go and track down the origins of like when I started writing about high crimes as an idea, or like the first time I wrote down the idea for Crowded. Like I think stuff like that is interesting, but, by and large, it's a lot of ideas that never got close to being in the book, or, just things that, I think they're not even that interesting to me, really. So I can't see how other people would be interested in them, but I like having them. Like, so if I ever want to, you know, sort of go back and look at, you know, revisit like when I was making Heartthrob, like I can pull that off the shelf and skim through it. And I've always sucked at keeping diaries. So, these are basically like my diaries.
Cool. Yeah. I like the idea of just having that where you saw the impetus for the thing happen. One of my, our mutual buddy, Dave Scheid, mm-hmm. you know, he shared, you know, his recent successful book, Mayor Good Boy. He shared like the iPhone note he had, like just Dog Mayor.
Yeah.
And what he did with that and how that ran. So, you know, there's at least one other person who's interested in that. I don't know if that's worth putting into a assembling for back matter, but yeah, if you ever do, I'm 100% there for that. All right.
Well, as long as there's one other person.
Yeah. If you're listening to this and you are, let Christopher know that you are into seeing the nitty gritties from the writing process. But I'm a process junkie, so I'm all about that stuff, from the scribbliest thumbnails and sketches and random notes on edge of pages and stuff like that to whatever. So
yeah, I'm a total, like, I try not to hoard anymore. I'm trying to sort of live in a reverse state where I'm jettisoning a bunch of stuff, but I get very into like keeping every scrap related to a project, like post-it notes. I'll just like, the Crowded notebook is crazy. Like I built a little like pocket in the back, inside cover, so I could like stick all the documents that were just like scraps of paper that I wrote random ideas on. So I try to keep them museum quality, at least. Like everything you need about it is in one place.
Yeah, I came across that conundrum for myself, where I had all these thumbnails for the graphic novel I did a couple years ago, and I'm like, what am I gonna do? Like, throwing them out seems wrong, but I'm not gonna use these for anything.
Sure.
And in a sense, they're already all scanned and in a hard drive somewhere, so they're technically preserved. So it's like, what do I do with this? But I still hold on to them, just because, I don't know. It's just that thing where it's part of the experience in the project, and you know, who knows if one day I'll want to look back fondly or whatever. I'll have an accident and lose my hand, and I'm like, oh, back when I could kind of draw. Look at that. Who knows?
Yeah, you know, you can always throw it out down the line.
Yeah, it can always be trashed later. That's a good point to bring up. Do you have like a favorite writing pen or anything like that, or are you not precious with that kind of stuff?
No, I do, and I am. I used to. Let's see. I used to swear by these ballpoint pens. I don't know what they are. They're like Pilots G5. There were these Pilot pens, and I was very into them, and I would only write with them. And then somebody, I think it was Brian Chirilla. Brian Chirilla is the one who gave me a bunch of brush pens, a bunch of his like half used and didn't want any more brush pens to mess around with. And I got really into the Kuretakis.
Okay.
They're just like regular Kuretake fine point brush pens. So I buy them. I'm actually about to make another order to buy a bunch of them from Jet Pens.
Oh yeah.
So I get like a dozen or so, and that lasts me. It can last me more than the year, but that accounts for like pen loss in the couch or God knows where. So yeah, if I don't have the, like, I can write with anything, but I, you know, if I'm required to, but yeah, the Kuretakis now just, you know, I'm pick it up and I'm like, okay, I know what this is to write about work stuff.
Okay. Yeah. I wonder if we're talking about the same Pilot pens, because there were these ones that I really, really liked, but I just couldn't find them anymore. They were real fine point, and they were annoying.
Yeah,
these
are still pretty available.
Okay.
But yeah, like, it's weird looking at my earlier notebooks when I just used that, because I would write very intensely. So like, it would be like the full impression of them on the back of the page and sometimes on the next page over. So I think that's one reason I moved into brush pens, is like, oh, I don't have to like, you know, I'm not like gouging my words into the page. So it's at least like chilled my my grip out a bit.
Yeah, that's definitely a thing just in general for art I've had to learn, is just like, just ease up a bit. A gentle touch will do, especially with those Kuretakis. Because, yeah, I think, am I on the Kuretakis right now? I float in between those, and there's like other brands that are pretty much the same thing, but just...
Yeah, I like Tombows. Tombows are fine. There's a Zebra. I like Zebra.
Yeah, Zebras are the ones I tend to go to first. I like Tombows.
Those just dry out for me quicker for some reason.
Oh yeah, 100%. They get real dry real fast. They are
okay.
They're not like, if you cap them and keep them, you know, I have to cap them, make sure I keep it upside down, just to make sure I'm not getting like, you know, too much of a dry thing. But
yeah,
I like coloring with the Tombows, but that's a different pen than what you're talking about. They have these cool marker pens that I like using. It's funny you were mentioning Chirilla, because I was just texting him back and forth a little bit today about nerdy guitar stuff. But So you're using an artist's pen, essentially, to do your writing, which, again, further bridges that gap in my brain where, like, you know, you having kind of like the writer's sketchbook with all that. So that, for some reason, that's appeasing a real nice little part of my brain. We're like, oh, that's cool. That's really cool.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's whatever gets me as close to the pro. Like, if somebody sat me down in front of a board and asked me to draw something, it'd be bad news for both of us. But I can get at least this close.
Nice. One of the books you brought up, Crowded, that was one of the ones that I think the idea you had just like blew me away, like just from the get-go, because not only is it just kind of like outrageous, but it also feels very, very possible, especially in this day and age. And I hate asking this question, but like, do you remember what the spark of Crowded came from for yourself?
I don't remember the specific thing. I mean, I know it was sometime in like 2013. I remember going outside. This was like when I was mostly flatting comics for a living. So I was just like, you know, when you flat stuff, it's just like, what can I watch that will take my mind off the fact that I'm flatting comics?
Yes.
So I had a lot of input coming in, but I remember stepping outside to have a cigarette and, you know, I think it was, I don't know, it was a combination of a couple different things. It was the thing about, I mean, politics was getting really divisive around then, like, you know,
yeah,
sort of the start, not the start of it, but it definitely felt like it was ramping up around then. So the idea, I mean, it all kind of came from the idea of like people sort of, you know, like one person can't go out and like kill a powerful person. But if you get 10,000 people together, they can hire somebody who can go out and take care of that powerful person. So it was that, and then it was kind of combined with what people label as like cancel culture, or the starts of it. Like I remember, like one of the big formative stories was that woman who was flying to Africa, and she like tweeted like, "Going to Africa, hope I don't get AIDS," and then turned her phone off, got on the plane, and then that tweet went everywhere, and by the time she landed, like she was the centerpiece of a, you know, a storm. And just that idea of like, I don't know, you can do something that seems so innocuous to you, and like the response can be so huge. Yeah, it was just like I just remember thinking like, you know, crowdfunding for assassinations, like it's like it's got to be something there. But it, you know, that was like the very start of the idea, but it took me forever to work it out to actually become Crowded. You know, for the longest time I just sort of had that idea, and was like trying to pitch it to publishers. I was like, listen, I know this is really good, and I think it's going to be really good. But I would send it to them, and they'd go like, yeah, it's a cool idea, but like, who's it about? And so that was a big, like, important thing for me, was figuring out that, like, you know, having a cool idea that, like, seems like something that might come true, like, that's, like, barely half the battle. Like, then you have to, you know, make it interesting. Something like that. It's just like, I could have just tweeted it and moved on. But yeah, I don't know. There was something there that just made me recognize like, this is really good. And I just hope I can do it before someone else gets to it.
Well, I'm glad you did, because Crowded has been excellent. I'm not 100% caught up, but On that note, we do have a question from Twitter from at Trey the Bruce. He wants to know, as respectfully as possible, what's the news on Crowded Volume 3?
February. I don't know if the official solicits are out yet, but yeah, it's coming out in February as a complete trade paperback, so you don't have to wait for issues. So it's the last 5 issues, and issue 5 is double-sized, so it's basically the last 6 issues. And yeah, that's kind of what we've been working on through pandemic. And we're just now, like, putting the finishing touches on it. We have to deliver everything next month to Image. So yeah, it's happening.
Awesome. So, you know, the one thing I should mention with Crowded is the art team you assemble in there is just phenomenal. And you have a real eye. Eye for working with artistic collaborators that seemed 100% perfect for whatever it is the story is. Is this do you have like a very set vision of what these books are going to look like? So you kind of search out for that style, or do you just kind of write what you have? And then, you know, when it's time to look, you just kind of, you know, have like a mental Rolodex of artists that you've been wanting to work with or so on and so forth?
Yeah, like this has all been a happy accident for me mostly. I'm not super good about thinking like, okay, this belongs in the hands of these people. I tend to write more towards an artist once an artist is like on board, but initially I'm just like writing a thing to write a thing. And then, I don't know. Then you just kind of like, you know, you just see certain people's work and you think it might speak to this, or, you know, you have no idea what it'll look like, but that still is like, that's intriguing enough to want to chase it. Yeah, I mean, there's a ton of artists that I want to work with. And so I kind of keep that in my back pocket of like anything that I land somewhere and we're looking for an artist, I can sort of quickly check and see if they're free. But yeah, mostly it's like, you know, I got extremely lucky early on, like two of my first creator owned books at Boom. Like they got really great artists with Chris Visions and Jonathan Brandon Sawyer and Claire Rowe. So, and then just a lot of people I've just, you know, met on social media or at cons and like, but I try not to get too attached because I know there's so many artists that I want to work with that like it's just never going to happen. So I try not to, I try not to take it too seriously.
Yeah, I've written a few things mainly for myself, but whenever I stop and think like, oh, you know, who would be a good fit for this if I would to, you know, hire on a separate artist for that? And it's just like, how do you choose, man? Like, yeah. I do not envy writers who, you know, have to make that decision. You know, even if I just like, well, let me keep it to people I know. Well, Jesus, that's just so many talented people. Like, and each one would be like, well, they would do something different, but it would also be really, really good. So yeah, how do you choose the version of the thing that you made? It's kind of insane. Now, you brought up Claire Rowe, so this is probably the smoothest segue as we'll have.
Sure. Yeah.
Into your latest book, your newest Kickstarter, which is still going on right now, Foul Brood. Would you mind letting everybody know exactly what Foul Brood is about?
Sure. Foul Brood's a comic about bees and crime and the intersection of bees and crime. It's a story about a guy who steals a bunch of beehives that belong to our main character, who owns an apiary and is renting out her bees to farmers. which is a real thing that happens. So then once she discovers all her bees are missing, she goes after the thief to try and track him down and get her bees back. And then in the mix of this is like this rural crime family that's protecting the bee thief, and it's this retired older couple who has a pack of psychopathic grandkids, and there's a pair of agricultural task force cops whose jobs normally are like dealing with like public dumping or stealing parts off of tractors, and now suddenly they're in the middle of this chaotic situation that just gets bigger and more violent, and all of it's swirling around bees.
Now, you know, as someone who's, you know, followed your social media for a few years now, it was really cool to see, like, I can't remember the first time you mentioned this, but you mentioned something about bees and all that. And what's one of the things I appreciate about what you do is you have a real knack for mentioning what you're working on or something you're developing on social media, but not really giving out like the meat of it. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, but you drop enough where it's like, well, that sounds different. That sounds interesting. Is that something you really, you know, you don't have to answer this if it's part of the mystique, but is that something you really kind of think about, or is it just like, man, no, bees and crying, that sounds pretty fucking cool, right? Like,
yeah, mostly it's, yeah, like I'm not good at mystique or branding or any of that. Like, it's just, yeah, stuff that I'm excited about. And the bee thing was like, as soon as I started working on it and figured out that it could work as a story, I've just been kind of like, you know, talking about it here and there just to remind people that like I'm still working on this thing that even to me, you know, sounded impossible when I first approached it as an idea. So I like, plus I like being able to like go back and say like, look, like this isn't just out of thin air. Like, I've been perseverating over this for years now.
And so the campaign for Foul Brood, you're not just doing one issue, you're doing issues one and two. Mm-hmm. Was this a difficult decision to make, or did you kind of just see the current landscape of Kickstarter where there's a lot of like single issues being funded and saying like, well, you know, with this team and the pedigree on this book, funding one issue seems definitely like, well, yeah, that seems like a no-brainer, that'll happen. So let's go for two and get like some more solid footing with that. Or was it just kind of running the numbers and like, well, in order to put all the work into the Kickstarter, we might as well do it for the first two?
Yeah, I mean, mostly it was that we had the first two issues done and it seemed like I didn't want to like drag it out. I mean, I would have run a campaign to fund the whole book, but I'm not nearly confident enough in myself to go out and ask for 40 grand from mm-hmm. the internet. Even asking for 15 seems like a very big ask, but it just seemed like a softer way to approach it. But it's just a thing that Claire and I, you know, we put it together. We pitched it to a publisher. They passed on it, which makes sense to me in retrospect, but at the time I was very much like, what? Why? But, you know, the more time I've had to live with the book, like, I get it. Like, it's not, I don't know, it's not like it's an avant-garde comic, but it's, we take our time. We're very much a slow burn kind of book. Like, we're not, you know, even in most of my work, you know, you feel sort of beholden to that comics formula of like, okay, well, you have to have at least like one really big action scene in every issue, or something, you know, dazzling like that. And it just didn't feel right for this book. Like, it felt like I didn't want to do it wrong. So, once it was, you know, sort of back in our hands of what to do with it, there was like one other publisher who was interested in it, but I think Claire and I had just been, we'd just been working on it together on our own for a while, and we didn't want to give up anything. Like, we just wanted to own it lock, stock, and barrel and sort of control our destiny on it. So we talked each other into doing a Kickstarter.
Okay. Well, that answers the next question I was going to have. Was this something that was considered to be pitched to somebody else? Or you just went from the get-go, want to do this on your own? But as you said...
No, if I can get somebody else to do like all the work of promoting and talking about a book, I would. But for me, if this all feels very necessary because I have to get better about like marketing my stuff. And marketing myself, which I'm just not good at. Like I'm much more interested in making the stuff and then putting it out in the world and then making something else. Mm-hmm. I'm very bad about like ringing the bell of like, hey, this thing I wrote, like you can go get it. Like I know it's 5 years old, but some of you probably haven't, which is like a smart, logical thing I should do, but I'm just, I don't know.
No, I 100% get you because that's one of the things that, you know, I struggle with a lot myself. It's just like, you need to be your own biggest cheerleader, but it's also like, well, can I just make the thing and put out the thing and then go to the next thing? And just,
I just want a professional cheerleader.
Yeah. And it's like, You brought up a good point of like, you know, this thing might be old and I'm going to promote it or whatever, because there's a chance someone, you know, might not have seen it either due to algorithms or they're a new follower to you and they weren't, you know, overly familiar with this idea or whatever.
Sure.
But it kind of feels like, you know, you also don't want to be like, well, I don't want to annoy everybody else with this constant promotion.
Yeah. And there's like, people, I don't want to be a salesman.
Yeah. And there's people who are really good about that. And, you know, I'm not good at doing it myself, but I do try to remind myself that whenever I do see someone I follow or whatever promoting themselves a lot and stuff they've done, like I don't really care that they're doing that. It's like, yeah,
sure,
it's social media. Of course you can do that. Like what? It's not like, oh my God, here he is again, posting the link to his book. Like, no, it's like, whatever. Okay. Like, you know, so, but you know, putting that into myself, you know, it feels more personal, like, oh no, I'm personally offending people who are following me because I am talking about this book that's a few years old, or I'm talking about this podcast that's like 3 days old, which, you know, as that, you know, in terms of like podcast listening, you know, after like 3 days, if it's that's your numbers.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah, no. And I feel like I have a bunch of people who follow me who do not care about comics. Like, you know, there's a bunch of people who are just there to see pictures of my dogs and kind of put up with the rest of my content as a, you know, an exchange they have to make. So I always, especially like if anybody like remotely like famous or somebody that who like whose opinion I deeply care about follows me, I'm just like I need to impress them.
Yeah. 100%. Whenever there's like a veteran to the industry or like a cool guitar person who's like follows me and I'm like, oh God, I don't want to annoy the shit out of them.
Yeah. But I've just kind of like tried to turn that part of my brain off. Like, so I figure like if it annoys you, then go. But like, I figure like the people who understand are the ones who understand. I don't know. It's like, I can't concern myself with like, who am I bugging with this? Like, none of this matters anyway. You know, it's just, it's social media. Like, I'm just overthinking it like I do everything else.
Yeah, yeah. And especially, it's just getting worse and worse and worse, just trying to get anything to break through the noise. I see, there's times where I see, you know, Kelly Williams, you know, at Treebeard, phenomenal artist. Mm-hmm. He's a buddy of mine. I'm, you know, if you're looking at algorithms and whatever, like there's lots of interaction between us. Yet there's still times where I know I've been scrolling my feed and I don't see something he posted and I'll see it later when someone else retweeted it.
Right.
And I'm like, why didn't I see this when I was, you know, like, and I have all the settings for, you know, not to be out of order and all that or whatever. So it's like, you just can't win.
Yeah.
So you know, telling myself, suck it up, buttercup, just promo the shit out of what you got, If people don't like it, there's the door. There, you know, a follow is not going to pay your bills, you know?
Yeah, pretty much. Like, you know, it's like, if, it's nice to have anybody who gives a crap about anything, I have to say, but, you know.
And more often than not, whenever I do something a little heavy promo wise for myself anyway, I tend just to get a little bit more engagement out of it as opposed to silence, you know? So if I post something in the morning, you know, I try to retweet it sometime in the middle afternoon, and then I'll quote tweet it later on in the evening or whatever. And that seems to work for me for the most part. But yeah, you know, even then, like, this at 3 times a day is like, that seems like too much sometimes.
Sure.
But even though it's like, not everyone is on Twitter all day, not everyone is on Instagram all day, just us weirdos for the most part. And generally speaking, not saying you are, because I don't know what you're, if you have like a strict social media policy for yourself.
No.
But yeah, so it's just like, just do the thing and promo it. And that's what scares me next, because the you know, the next big project I have is going to be a Kickstarter thing in the spring. And I'm like, man, I'm going to have to really get over myself to try to, you know, promo this and make sure that hits, because yeah, it's, I don't know. It's such a shitty thing we have to do. You know, it'd be really nice if we could just put the thing out and make the thing, as I said.
Yeah, ultimately, like, I don't know. Yeah, you got to find a way to, there's some sort of balance of like being able to promote yourself without turning into just like one of these people who that's all they do.
Yeah. 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 It's a balance of like having a thing to promote and just promoting you, which to an extent I understand, but it's also like you need to kind of have a body of work for that kind of stuff. And like, so promoting your brand or whatever doesn't work when you have like, you know, less than a dozen pages of comics to your name. I'm not calling anybody out or anything like that. I'm just saying in general, it's like, you know, cart before the horse here.
Yeah. But I think also like people with like huge libraries, like also like people aren't, you know, people chose to follow them because they like what they do. And I think to some extent, like want to see what else they think, you know. It's not like, it's like at a certain point you're like, okay, I get it. Like, you know, like, could you move on to something else?
Mm-hmm.
I also think like, you know, using your whatever platform you have to like promote other people's work. You know, I've been lazy about it the last 2 years. So it's all of this is like a good incentive for me to like kind of revamp my shit and, get better about this stuff, which is like, you know, it's actual like business stuff. You know, as much as I joined Twitter just to dick around,
mm-hmm.
like now it's, you know, it's part of my career, I guess. So I have to start treating it, I guess, with a little more seriousness, but not too much.
Well, there was that the early 2010s of Twitter was like really kind of fun, I want to say. It was, you know, a lot of just like more casual interactions and things like that. And then, and then somewhere around the mid, you know, around 2014, 2015, it really just became like, oh no, this is how, you know, majority of the people like try to do their business, either do promotion or contacts or things like that. And, you know, it seems like I have cell numbers for people, for friends, but I sometimes, but instead of like sending them a text, I still send them like a Twitter DM.
Sure.
So it's like, why am I doing, like, I try to catch myself when I do it, but it's like, why would I go to this app when I literally have a direct line to them from there? It's, yeah, it's, it just so quickly became this ubiquitous thing that you had to do that now it's like, every time I think about quitting social media or whatever, it's like, well, I can't quit Twitter because how am I going to promo my stuff and all that? Because like Facebook, yeah, who needs Facebook? You know, Instagram, that's a whole nother nut to crack and that's constantly changing anyway. So it's like, it's kind of stuck with this, I guess, for now.
Yeah. I mean, I, you know, as much of a garbage fire as it is, like, I still like Twitter. Like,
I can't fault it for, you know, it being a complete trash fire, like a garbage fire, like you said, because I've met a ton of amazing people even within the past year, you know, on this website. So it's like, it's just trying to, maybe having a better perspective of how you engage with it and use it.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, all of us need to spend much less time on it than we do.
Oh yeah, for sure. Well, speaking of spending time, I'm curious, are you going to be going to C2E2 this year?
No.
Okay.
I'm not doing Emerald City either.
Okay.
Like, next year I'm going to get back into doing cons, but, I'm kind of waiting for, I don't know what I'm waiting for, but I guess myself to feel more comfortable with being in a huge setting like that. I did go to, I like popped into Rose City for an hour or two here in Portland a couple months ago, and that was fine. Like, I didn't like feel, you know, it's not like I ever have felt like freaked out. I'm just, I don't know. The last 2 years have made it clear that, like, oh, you can't really trust, like, your fellow citizens to do anything for the benefit of anyone except themselves. So,
yeah.
And C2E2 is, like, I only did it one year.
Oh, okay.
And I enjoyed it, but I also, like, I didn't make any money. That was very early in my career, though. Like, I only had, like, 2 or 3 books, maybe.
I think that was 2014, I want to say, or maybe 2015.
One of those.
Yeah.
I mean, the best thing about that C2E2 was I met Sven Gulli. So, which was like, you know, lifelong dream. So there was that, and I don't know, like I met a couple of people that I went to high school with who came to the show, which was interesting. And then some dude gave me a joint of some of the best weed I've ever smoked.
I remember you tell. Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, I was selling like these. Printed issues of High Crimes, like the first 2 chapters in that I had printed in a single issue. And this dude came by, and he looks at it, he goes, "High Crimes, eh?" I was like, "Yeah." He's like, "So, does anybody smoke any weed in this book?" And I was like, "Yeah, no, there's definitely drug usage in it." And he's like, "Well, what would you feel, or how would you feel about a trade?" And like, shows me this joint. And I was like, "Yes, of course. Like, I'm going to say yes to this." Just to have the story. But then that night outside of the hotel, I smoked some of it. I got so hot. Like, it was just amazingly good. Like, and it just reeked. Like, I remember I could only smoke a little bit of it. And then I went back up to the hotel room, where I was sharing a room with, I don't know how many, there were at least 4 other people in the room. And like, yeah, I mean, like, I just stank the room up with like this. So, and it was cool being back in Chicago. Like, I want to do C2E2 again. But now they're saying the next one's in August, and it's like, I am not going to Chicago in August.
Yeah, that's going to be rough.
Like, can you pick some median between, like, the 2 worst seasons?
I don't know why late spring or fall, it seems to be, like, just, like, this dead zone where they don't want to put it. That's, like, the perfect season to put a Chicago show.
Well, that's when I went to C2E2, it was, like, in the fall.
Yeah, used to be, like, in the, like, mid to late April, and they kept bringing it back.
Yeah, maybe it was spring, yeah. Which was super pleasant. Like, it was, like, great. I'm so glad to be back in Chicago, like, with weather that I can, you know, endure.
Just anything past March, guys, but, like, before July.
Yeah.
Or September, October would be great, even though New York's in October, and I'm sure they don't want to cut into that. But, yeah, it's nuts. Well, that does lead us to our second Twitter question, and that is from Kirk Spencer. He wants to know if you plan on returning to Heroes Con Love getting comics signed by you at the show.
Yeah, no, that's Heroes is on my very short list of shows that I will like travel to do. I think it's the only one. Like maybe New York Comic Con again someday, but I plan if they'll let me show up, I plan to be at Heroes.
Nice. Yeah, whenever I'm talking to a writer and cons come up and stuff like that, I always like feel a little bad for you guys, because it's like you guys have such a higher like hill to climb in terms of like recouping any type of cost if possible to attend these shows and all that. And unless you're like invited and a big name and all that, it's basically like I'm gonna lose money, but hopefully this is an investment to something else later down the line.
Yeah, like the only reason I made money at New York Comic Con in 2019 is because I was printing out all these 3D printed Judge Dredd badges with people's names on them. And I sold like, I don't know how many, but I sold enough that I paid for like my flight and my table. And I was staying with Matt Rosenberg, so I didn't have to worry about accommodation. But like if I had to pay for all that plus accommodations and try and make money, like there's no way.
Yeah.
But it's a fun show to do. Like, so if I can arrange it to do it where I don't worry about, my main concern doing shows is like, I just don't want to lose money. Mm-hmm. Like it would be awesome to make money, but again, as a writer, I don't go in expecting that I'm going to, make a heap of money. But there are certain shows, Emerald City has always been good for me, and it's close enough that I can just drive up there. And I always do pretty well at that. Heroes, I do pretty well at. So, it sucks for us, but, I don't know. We're not all working on commissions in our room at night.
Yeah, there's that trade.
So we get some upside.
Oh yeah, I'm not going to name names for anybody, but yeah, just quite a few times where I'm talking to somebody, and I'm like, oh, what's your plans for the evening? Maybe we'll go grab a bite. He's like, and they're like, nah, man, I got like, I don't know why I took all these commissions.
Like literally every artist I know, like that is the thing. I hear it, every night of a show. Like, what are you up to? Like, oh, like a bunch of us are going to just work on our commissions in the room tonight. Like, so like for writers, it's just like, I don't know, I'm going to get really drunk and then probably do something I'll regret, and then I'm going to go to bed.
To be a big enough artist to where it's like, you're invited to the show, you don't have to pay for a table, and you could just like offer head sketches for like the 3 hours you're going to be signing, and then like you just have the rest of the weekend to just fuck around the city or hang out at the show. That's the dream right there for conventions, I think.
I think for all of us, like even as as carefree as writers can be at cons, like you go to these shows and you go to these towns that you don't live in, and you barely get to explore the place you're staying at, because like you spend all day, 8-9 hours like talking to people, mm-hmm. and in salesman mode, and when it's done, it's just like you're kind of drained, and it's like, oh well, I guess I am in New York, but I'm very sleepy, so I'm just gonna go back to my room and lay down. So I think that's the dream, is like to get to a point where you're not overextending yourself, and you can, both enjoy the show and enjoy the place that you are at, or at least explore it a bit.
100%. You mentioned the 3D printing thing, and I recall that was something you're kind of getting into for a while. Is that something you're still kind of messing around with, or was it something that kind of fizzled out like hobby wise, or is it just something you just haven't had time for?
It hasn't, it's not gone. It is definitely like diminished from that. There's a very heady, exciting period where you're like, oh man, I can just like make things out of nothing. And just like, well, let's see how many things I can make out of nothing. Like, crap I don't even need. I'm going to see if I can make one. So then I, but then I upgraded to this, bigger, fancier. Well, also 3D printing is a very weird world where like the bigger and sort of more capable the machine gets, the less capable it gets for just some schmo to run it. So like my initial machine is like all in one. It's just a 3D printer for dummies. But you know, it printed out everything I needed it to. And then I got this fancier one and it was just like pulling teeth trying to get it to do what I could get my other printer to do with no problem. So it kind of bummed me out for a while. And I've been slowly getting back into it. I'll print out stuff that I need. Like I just printed out it's just like a piece of plastic that's like half, it's like a square, cut diagonally as like a shower guard, to keep water from splashing out from one side of the shower. And it totally works. So just like if I need to make something very specific and it's not too much of a headache to do it, I do want to get back into making boxes and stuff again. It was one of those things where you get really deep into a hobby where it's like becomes like this weird mania. And then I don't know, it's like a, it's like lust or something. Like it can only last for so long and then it wears off and you're like, why did I go so crazy? So I think I'm in recovery from the, boy, I went really crazy about 3D printing for a while.
I can 100% sympathize with that. Many, many, many moons ago at the turn of the century, I was into photography. I was taking photography classes at Columbia in Chicago. And I'm like, well, I have this old, well, not old, but this shitty Ryko camera, you know, manual everything or whatever. And I'm like, well, I'm going to upgrade. I'm going to get this nice Canon 2000 whatever camera, whatever. But like to do, like you were saying, to do what I could do in like three or four moves, just unconsciously at that point with my old camera, it's like going to a menu and doing this and finding this and trying to tweak this aperture and this, and it became so complicated, which is like, it just like deflated all the excitement I had for that. And then, much less, digital photography now where it's like, as much as I would love to get back into that kind of stuff, it's like, just, there seems to be too many menu options and things like that. And, I think at this point, there's probably something I could, a camera that I could like manually switch all this, the f-stop and aperture and all that, and it'd still be digital. But that'd probably be so much money at this point. not worth getting back into. But I, long story rambling aside, I totally sympathize with the hurdle of like, oh, let me get the next better thing. It's like, oh, this just, yeah.
Yeah, it's terrible. It's like if you bought a new guitar and then suddenly it's like, oh no, you have to play guitar differently on this than you played it on your other one. You'll have to figure that out.
Yeah. So exactly. Well, I hope you get back into it because you're making some cool stuff. It seemed like a fun hobby. Like I am really drawn to the idea of like just make the thing that you need.
Like, yeah, I need that. I mean it's really cool to like, yeah, if I need to generate like just some weird, if I need to make a shower guard, I can make a shower guard it's like it's part of my life, but it's not like before it would be like, the moment I woke up I would go to the machine to check how the print that I started before I went to bed is doing. you know, a lot of stuff like revolved around like, okay, how long is this going to be printing? Like, can I get this printed before I go to sleep? Because if I need to start a print before I go to bed, otherwise I'm wasting 7 hours. Like, it was just like really weirdly obsessive. It was like, I have to keep producing, I keep making objects. So I've, it's good to take a step back. Like, I've started to like melt down a lot of that stuff that, you know, I discovered a pair of like oversized dice that I made. I was like, I don't use dice for anything. And I just have these two novelty sized dice that I was just like, well, this seems easy to print. I'll just print this just to have it. Like, it's a weird form of hoarding where you generate the objects that you hoard.
Yeah. There's this YouTube channel called I Like to Make Stuff that I'm just not obsessed with, but I'm just, it's one of those things where it's like, yeah, man, I wish I had all that stuff just to make the things I need, like this guy is doing. Like, and they do like 3D printed stuff and all that stuff too. And it's just like, it'd be really cool. But then, you know, like anything else that seems really cool to me, I'm like, there's just no way I can get into it because it's just going to become a thing. Like vinyl,
yeah,
or guitar pedals. Like, I can't start like getting these things because it's just, I'm just going to be obsessed with it and I'm going to lose, you know, all productivity trying to like chase this dragon.
Yeah. And space. Like, yeah. It's, you know, yeah. Well, I think once you commit to vinyl, then you really have to reduce your other hobbies. Mm-hmm. Like, cause like, yeah, moving with vinyl is one of the worst nightmares in the world. And yeah, like 3D printing is like, it takes up, you know, the machine can be pretty small, but then it's like, well, you have all these rolls of filament. Where are you going to store those? Or in my case, like, I started buying other power. Like, I have a sander. I don't know why I have a sander. I mean, I do. I bought it so I could sand down these, like, I was printing wood filament boxes. So I would use it to sand that. But like, I also have a Dremel kit and a drill. Like, I have these tools that it's like, why do I have these? And it's like, well, because I got so into 3D printing that like, I decided I needed these extraneous tools to make the whole thing better. Like, I think it's akin to vinyl in that, like, you should only really get into collecting vinyl, I think, when you like own a home where you know that you're not going to be moving.
Yeah.
And I think with 3D printing for me, I think it got to a point where it's like, I wish I just had a shed in my backyard that I could put all this stuff. Like, this would just be my workshop. Cause I think having it mixed up, you know, like having it 4 steps from my kitchen sort of, removes some of the magic from it.
100%. 100%. Well, Chris, it's been a blast having you on and getting a chance to talk to you after a few years.
Yeah, thanks.
I'm, you know, as of right now, Foul Brood is chugging along on Kickstarter. You are,
yep.
You know, by the time this posts next Friday, I hope that you've blasted to the goal. You're hitting your stretch goals. But this will go out with, you know, still roughly 6 or 7 days left in the campaign.
Ooh, yeah.
There's going to be a link in the show notes for everybody to go check it out. Right now is the time to let everybody know where they can find you on social media.
Yeah, mostly I'm on Twitter, and I'm Xtop, X-T-O-P, and that's also my name on Instagram. So I don't really, I did open a TikTok account, but I don't think I'm going to, I think I'm too old to use it.
Yeah, TikTok. I get my TikTok videos from Reels, from Instagram, whatever is recycled out of there. And my wife gets her TikTok from compilations on Facebook. So we're not super old, but we're old. We're too old to actually be on TikTok proper.
Yeah, like I was thinking about like just making a TikTok for my dog, but like not promoting it at all. It would just be like a secret TikTok with videos of my dog. But then their editing platform is weirdly in depth. I was kind of impressed.
Yeah, some of these things I see people posting and sharing, I'm like, that's intense. Like, that's on an app? Like,
yeah, it's crazy. Like, yeah, just the amount of like on the fly editing you can do within one clip. And I was just like, this is too, like, I thought this was just some cheap jack app where, like, you know, you pick a song to plug in and like put some text over it. But it's like, no, I like, if I start, it feels like it would take me an hour to get this video the way I want.
It'd be another 3D printing thing, and just,
yeah, it's like, this is not, except with that, at least I have something at the end. With this, I have the same video of my dog, except it's weirdly edited.
Well, there's nothing stopping you from doing just a Zola exclusive Instagram.
But no, the thing that's stopping me is like, I made this decision that like she's not getting her own accounts because like people would just abandon mine.
Oh, you know, like I would not, but I understand.
No, like yeah. I would assume like some people wouldn't, but I assume a bunch of people like I know, you know, how the cards are stacked. I know a lot of people are here for my dog. So now it's like, well, if you want to see pictures of my dog, you have to wade through my content too.
Oh, there, you see that's a very fair trade-off, I think.
Yeah, like I do everything for her. She doesn't have to.
She helps you out with a little bit of promo, maybe, you know, get a few, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Like just a little exploitation of my dog is fine.
Well, you know what? I was wrapping up, but I do have to bring up the Mint Mobile ad. Was it?
Oh yeah.
Was it as straightforward as it seems? Where you literally just tweeted and like print a picture of my dog.
Yeah, I mean, the only behind the scenes stuff is that Ryan Reynolds and I guess, are like friendly with each other. Mm-hmm. Like we've talked in the DMs. So I wasn't just like some dude. Like he follows me. So I guess I have just slightly more access than just a random person asking him to put their dog in an ad. But I know that, again, he's somebody who likes my dog.
Yeah.
So, it was just a weird, I was just like making a joke. And then suddenly I had like the dude from Mint Mobile, like emailing me saying like, okay, well, you need to sign this release for your dog. So it was a very weird experience.
Awesome. Well, Chris, once again, it was a blast having you on. It was great talking to you. And
yeah, thanks.
Yeah, everyone, go check out Foul Brood on Kickstarter. Thanks for listening to the Comics, Coffee, Metal podcast. Please be sure to return next week with my guest, Shadia Amin.